yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yeah, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found, whose crimes have gone unpunished now, walk the streets a screaming now. All you 99 percenters, this is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, today we're going to do a review of a number of interesting reports and issuances of data and events of the past week, just to maintain a sense or pulse of what's going on as the summer doldrums continue. Of course, the fight over health care reform, if you can call it reform, continues here, the sideshow. And in addition, the one wing of the traditional ruling elites is keeping up its pressure on Trump, particularly the Russia connection. And that will continue throughout the summer. And the big event at the end of the summer, I think, is going to be what happens at Jackson Hole, Wyoming, where the central bankers of the world, led by the Federal Reserve, gather once again, as they do annually, and provide some signals whether we're going to see further rate hikes, interest rate hikes by the Fed and other central banks, and whether they're going to start selling off their bloated balance sheets. And how much do they have on their balance sheets, and how did these central banks accumulate these balance sheets? Well, they did it by providing free money to the bankers for 9 years now. Zero interest rates, which were made possible primarily by what's called quantitative easing, bond, direct bond buying by the central banks, and stock buying in other central banks, not in the U.S., but elsewhere. In other words, propping up the prices of financial assets for 9 years and producing massive capital gains for all these investors in stocks and corporate bonds and derivatives and you name it, right? That's the source of these huge, ultimate source of these huge increases in stock and bond prices, and therefore in capital gains income for the wealthiest 1%. And of course, along the way, the politicians have made sure that they cut the taxes on capital gains. So all these big price bloated driven financial asset gains are kept, not paid to the government in terms of reasonable taxes, and they even go beyond that, these corporations, and don't pay anything to government by shuffling all these profits offshore to their offshore subsidiaries or moving their headquarters offshore and recording the profits offshore and keeping the money offshore, over $2 trillion minimum. Hoarded offshore by these companies, but particularly the manufacturing tech companies, not just manufacturing, but social media tech companies, you know, the Apples, the Amazons, the Googles and so forth, Facebooks. These are the big players who keep all their money offshore and don't want to pay taxes. And now they have the gall to demand big tax cuts and eliminate all taxes on offshore profits, right? They call this territorial tax, eliminate all their profits. Well, they're just going to shuffle more money offshore if they don't have to pay anything offshore, right? That's coming. That's the next big issue after this health care so-called reform. And don't forget, this health care reform is really a tax issue. You know, all from the very beginning, it's all about, you know, the repeal is all about, driven by the Koch brothers and others like them, Adelsons and Mercers and so forth, to eliminate the tax on the wealthy, which amounted to $600 billion, right? That's what the repeal was about, get rid of it, get rid of the $600 billion and pay for the big tax cuts for these wealthy investors who were financing in part the ACA, and get rid of it by cutting $800 billion out of Medicaid. That's what this thing is all about, and they can't seem to find a solution to that dilemma, to that contradiction, because they know. They know only, what is it, 17 or 22% poll show of people in the U.S. Want a repeal of Obamacare, ACA, as poor as that plan is in terms of controlling prices and so forth. You know, I mean, the major part of that was $800 billion and mostly for Medicaid coverage. You know, and of course, there was the mandates and open market purchases of those who could afford it. But the big essence was, you know, the Medicaid coverage for the poor who couldn't afford to buy anything. Not just the poor, you know, disabled, low-wage, working-class people and everything. Well, only 17% want the thing repealed, but this wonderful Congress we got stumbling over themselves trying to find a solution. You know, at one end you got the ideologues on the right, you know, the puppets for the Koch brothers, and, you know, they want it repealed outright. And then, you know, you have the middle-of-the-road Republicans up there in New England and a few other places who are really nervous if they repeal this thing because their constituents say no, no, no. 4 to 5 say no, 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 don't do it. So they got a real dilemma there, and we'll see what happens. They'll come up with something. Yeah, they'll come up with something. Anyway, there's other important news here of the past week, not just health care. Continuing developments in healthcare. Let's review a few of these things and, that are of import here, right? Okay. Today, Friday, the 28th of July, we have a release of a second quarter revised U.S. gross domestic product GDP figures. And as part of those GDP figures, inflation figures, what's called Personal Consumption Expenditures Index. And what does that show? That shows a 0.3% increase in inflation in the second quarter of this year. 0.3% annual rate. Well, that's a way below the Federal Reserve Central Bank's goal and target of 2% PCE inflation rate. Now, you don't get such a low inflation, you know, virtually stagnant prices for goods and services, not prices for stocks and bonds, financial assets. That's not included in these inflation indexes. But what 0.3% really shows is that the economy is slowly stagnating. I don't care what these GDP figures say. When you have that less, that low amount of inflation, it means people just aren't able to afford buying things the way they used to. Now, there are aberrations and exceptions to the rule here or there, this industry, that product line, so on and so forth, but 0.3%. And, you know, a lot of that has to do with escalating rental prices. Yeah, rental price, particularly on the coasts in certain places. So if you adjusted out the rental cost, you know, we're probably stagnant prices. And the Fed's target is 2%. You know, the Fed has justified this quantitative easing, direct bond buying, $4.5 trillion on its balance sheet. Actually, as I've revealed in previous shows, it's really about $7 trillion because there's cumulative replacement of bond buying that's been going on to keep it at $4.5 trillion. Okay, so, you know, the Fed, $4.5 to $7 trillion, its justification has been, well, we got to get prices up to 2%. That's why we continue doing this and replacing and run this balance sheet of $4.5 trillion. And when you throw in the Bank of England and the European Central Bank And other banks, Switzerland Bank, Riksbank of Sweden, and so forth, you got over $10 trillion just in North Atlantic, North America, Europe. I counted Japan, China, of bond buying, direct bond buying. The whole idea, or justification, I should say, by these central banks has been to keep prices, to get prices up to 2%. Well, they're nowhere near it. Not in Europe, you know, not in the U.S. Nowhere near it. Oh, but we've continued for 9 years now with that excuse, false objective, 2%, 9 years of pumping, you know, $4 to $7 trillion into the system, into the banks, and it results in low interest rates, virtually less than 1% for a while there, you know, 0.15% for about 5 years. The banks could borrow from the Federal Reserve Central Bank at 0.15%. And then, by the way, they could leave the money there, and the Fed would pay them 0.25%. So in other words, you borrow money, leave it there, and make money doing nothing. Yeah, that's how lucrative this whole thing was. But in the meantime, you know, my grandma, grandpa, retirees, making nothing on their savings, going further and further in debt, trying to maintain their standard of living, over $1 trillion redistributed from households, retired households, to the banks and their buddies. So the banks borrow at virtually nothing. Nothing, and of course they loan it out at 4, 6, 8%, and nice spread. You know, all this talk about banks losing money and they need to raise rates is BS. They make big money from super low interest rates, super low. You see, when the economy is not growing very well, they make more money by super low rates, and then they can make money by raising rates as well. They make it both ways. Okay, so we have this PCE inflation rate of 0.3%, actually closer to zero. And the Fed has been saying all along we got to continue pumping money into the economy to get the rate up to 2%. Well, it's bullshit. They've never had that target as a real target. The whole idea was to subsidize the banking system for 9 years, and that's what they've been doing. And that's what they will continue to do because, as I've said in previous shows, the central banks have taken on a new function, a new purpose, you know, a new mission. And the global economy has crossed the Rubicon of sorts since 2008-09. And that big change is that the prior central bank function of lender of last resort, i.e. bailout banks who are in trouble, has transformed into a new function, which is a permanent subsidization of the private banking system. And I mean shadow banks as well as commercial banks, regulated banks. All right, that's the big change, a big change. There have been a number of big changes, but that's a fundamental change here. And now the Fed's saying, well, we've got to try to raise interest rates. And as I've been arguing, they can't raise them much more. No, because the system is addicted to the free money. I recently wrote an article for European Financial Review that's available on my website, which is Kyklos Productions, KYKLOSProductions.com, or you can go to my blog for it as well, jackrasmus.com. And the article is called The Limits of Central Bank's Emerging Policy Shift. The emerging shift, of course, is after 9 years of zero rates, they're trying to raise rates. And after $4.5 to $7 trillion in bloated balance sheets by the Fed, the central bank, buying up stocks and bonds at above market prices for investors for 9 years here, well, 7, 8 years. After all this low rates and bond buying and so forth, they're trying to raise rates. Well, why are they raising rates after 9 years? Well, it's not because they've got their 2% inflation target. No, they're moving in the opposite direction from that, you know, which shows that that's been a phony target from the beginning. They're trying to raise rates because they know another recession is coming. And as I've predicted here, end of 2018, we're going to see, or maybe even earlier, we're going to see another recession in the U.S. Okay, so the Fed, the central banks, need to raise rates in order to get a little cushion so they can lower them again. They won't have any major tool here anymore in the next recession, and they know that. So they're trying to raise rates. But as I say in my article here at the European Financial Review, they're not going to be able to raise them much more. I predict, you know, right now the federal funds rate of the central bank and the Fed is at 1.25%. And they're not going to be able to get that to 2% or more. Without precipitating a major contraction in the real economy and or precipitating a major correction in the stock and bond markets. We already have the, you know, on the cusp of emerging global bond market route, but the stocks are in bubble territory. U.S. stock markets are in bubble territory. They're not going to be able to raise those rates up to 2%. Or the long bond rate, which is the 10-year Treasury yield, you know, which is about 1.4, somewhere around there, right? They won't be able to get that up to 3%. Okay. I think it's a little bit more than 1.4. I think that's the five-year rate, Treasury bond rate. I think it's like 2-something, the 10-year benchmark Treasury bond. So they can't move it much more. And that's going to be interesting. If they do continue to do that, they will precipitate a recession. And that's what I'm predicting they'll try to do. And that's what I'm predicting will happen by the end of 2018. Okay, so that's the emerging policy shift to reverse the zero interest rates and bond buying, start selling off some of the bonds that they've accumulated on the Fed balance sheet, which will be so token, they'll announce this probably in September, it'll be insignificant. But if they have a significant sell-off of bonds, that will raise rates as well. So it's just going to be token window dressing. And we'll see whether they continue raising interest rates here at their peril, right? And all the other central banks are watching. You know, the European Central Bank, the Bank of England, Bank of Japan, they're all watching what the U.S. Fed does, because the Fed has become the central bank of central banks globally. They all key off of the Fed. And we'll see what happens at the end of August at the Jackson Hole, Wyoming meeting. Janet Yellen will have something to say. She'll give more signals. Mario Draghi of the European Central Bank will be there, and he will give more signals. I'm not sure who will represent the Bank of England or Bank of Japan, but we will see what they all say. Because the capitalist system is driven by monetary policy now. Yeah, fiscal policy has been put on the shelf. In some places, fiscal policy means a retraction of prior fiscal spending. That's called austerity, and or virtually no spending at all. That's why this infrastructure spending bill is going nowhere in the U.S. and will continue to go nowhere in the U.S. because they don't want that. They don't want spending. They don't want government spending because that, you know, boosts the incomes of a working and middle class, and the whole, you know, should lead theoretically to increased economic consumption and activity, which then indirectly may boost corporate profits and bank profits. No, no, they don't want that. They want monetary policy, which is, you know, pump the cash into our pockets and maybe we'll dribble a little bit down. That's what they want. And that's why monetary policy, central bank policy, has been ruling the roost since 2009. That's another fundamental change in the global capitalist system here. Monetary policy is prime, except in China. China, they're still running fiscal policy and monetary policy together. So we will see what happens here after the Jackson Hole meeting. The Federal Reserve had a meeting this past week where it said it's not making an announcement on rate hikes, but it will make an announcement on its balance sheet, and that's going to sell off, and that's going to be in September, right? Okay, so if you're interested in further detail of this analysis of mine, go to my blog, jackrasmus.com. The lead article there is Limits the Central Bank's Emerging Policy Shift. And, of course, all this is part of my just-released book here this week. And you can purchase it on my website from the icon through PayPal, or you can purchase it beginning August 1st, I believe, from Amazon and other public sources, right? The title is Central Bankers at the End of Their Ropes, Monetary Policy in the Coming Depression. I'll also be writing an article that will appear in Z Magazine on the book's major themes. And the Z article will be how the Fed and central banks are the key determinant of income inequality, growing income inequality in the U.S., and these constant financial asset bubbles that's brewing again. Well, how does the central bank, how is it responsible for income inequality? Well, if you want to analyze income inequality, you've got to do it a little more thoroughly than Paul Krugman and some of the others have done. You know, you can't just look at stagnating and declining wage incomes, which, of course, is true, although they don't fully understand why wage incomes are stalled and or decline. We'll talk about that shortly some more here. But inequality is also a function of rising capital incomes. In fact, the escalation, acceleration of capital incomes is playing a bigger role in income inequality than even the wage stagnation. And those capital incomes are the result of stock bubbles and booms in financial asset markets, stocks, bonds, derivatives, foreign exchange, etc., which then capital gains get converted to capital gains, and the tax system has been changed here in the last 15 years to ensure that those capital gains, the lion's share, is kept by the investors, you see. Yes, it's in a sense, fiscal policy in the form of tax cuts for investors has accompanied the shift to monetary policy that has caused these booms in financial asset markets, stocks and bonds and so forth. The wealthy get to keep more of their bubbled income, and that's what's driving income inequality. Well, anyway, Z Magazine, and I will post it on my blog once it's published early August, will be about how the Fed and central banks are the key cause of income, one of the key causes of income inequality and financial bubbles. All right. Talk about bubbles. Do we have a bubble in the U.S. stock market? Well, I've been saying that we do. You know, if you look at the NASDAQ stock, tech stock market, it's at really record levels, way higher than it was during the dot-com bust, right? Keep in mind that 60% of all those price increases in the NASDAQ, which is the tech-heavy stock market, are due to rising stocks of just a half a dozen companies. I'm talking about the Amazons, the Apples, the Facebooks, Alphabet, Google, and a few others. Yeah, over half of it is runaway prices, stock prices for those companies. You know, we've looked at it just in the last 6-7 months, we've had 30% increase in the stock prices of these companies, 20-30%, Amazon leading the way. Okay, well, when that tech bubble busts, everything is going down in the NASDAQ. What about the Dow? The Dow, the S&P 500 and the Dow stock, general stock market. Well, it's run up in the last year from 17,000 to over 22,000, almost 22,000 here. That's like a 30% run-up in 1 year in stock valuations. Don't tell me that's not a bubble, especially since it's being driven by margin buying and margin loans. How much? Well, it's hard to get a true estimate because there's different forms of margin buying and margin loans. And a lot of it is proprietary information that the brokers don't really reveal. But well over $500 billion in margin buying and loans since 2010. Maybe $800 billion, as high as $800 billion going on. Oh, that's a bubble. That's a bubble. And the other big indicator of a stock bubble is what's called the yield curve. You know, short-term rates and long-term rates, when they flatten or come closer to each other, that's an indication that you got a bubble and you got an imminent recession. You know, that the yield curve has predicted every recession in decades, recent decades, and the yield curve is approaching that prediction once again. Okay, so important data on inflation, important event information on the Federal Reserve and the Open Market Committee and what its decisions the past week and what's coming up, and connections to the bubble that's going on right now. Okay. All right, so what other important announcements here? Well, we've got this guy Scaramucci, who is now appointed the communications director for Trump. Why is that excuse me, why is that significant? Well, because excuse me. Well, because Scaramucci is another Goldman Sachser. Yes, we got Steve Mnuchin here running the Treasury, ex-Goldman Sachser. We got Bill Dudley, Goldman Sachser, running the very important New York Federal Reserve District. Several indicators of the past week that Trump is going to appoint the Gary Cohn, who's his economics director, to the Fed chair here when Yellen's term ends in January of 18. Okay. And Scaramucci is now running the show in terms of communications director. This is government by Goldman Sachs. Yes. And who is this Scaramucci? Well, he's another big shadow banker, hedge fund guy. He ran this hedge fund of hedge funds, as they call them. And before accepting the position, sold off his company to this very strange company, Chinese conglomerate called HNA. Sold it off to HNA on very shadowy conditions here. There's a scandal brewing here with HNA as investigations by China into HNA and by the U.S. On the U.S. side as well. What is this HNA? What's going on? Well, this Scaramucci is another wheeler dealer. That's all we got in this administration, the bunch of shadow bank finance wheeler dealers. And that's what Trump is, of course. He's just a financial wheeler dealer here. It's not hotels. He wheels and deals the financial arrangements associated with his properties. That's how he makes his money, and that's why he won't reveal his taxes. He probably won't reveal it either because he's got probably has a long history playing fast and loose with Russian oligarchs. And if they reveal his taxes, they'll see all these connections to the Russian oligarchs over there who are the same kind of breed. You know, I mean, Trump is an American oligarch, you know, the same kind of fast and loose. And, of course, lying is the name of their trade. Okay, So that's interesting. Scaramucci, we'll see how that plays out. And apparently there's talk of him in a turf fight here with Steve Bannon and some others within the administration, you know. Hopefully they'll poison each other. All right, so another interesting piece of information was the U.S. GDP report, that, as I said, was released. And we talked about today, and we talked about the inflation, almost zero, and yet the Fed's raising rates. Just proves, as I said, I got to repeat this one more time, that the 2% goal is just BS, you know. That's for public consumption. And so is the 4.5% unemployment rate goal. That was for public consumption as well, because they weren't reaching the 2% for 9 years, so they had to come up with another target, you know. And so they're at the target here, and they're trying to raise rates, but they're not going to get away with it. Okay, so let's talk about the U.S. GDP. We saw first quarter this year 1.2%. which is a big revision. It was actually much less than that initially. And keep in mind, at least three-tenths of all quarterly GDP figures are due to redefinition of GDP back in 2013. So you got to reduce it all by at least three-tenths of $500 billion. Okay, so, 1.2%. Now, second quarter, 2.6%. Well, if you believe their figures, you don't make any adjustments, it's about 1.8%. Well, that's just the average for years now of U.S. growth, the average. But if you peel back the onion on this report, you can see that housing is contracting. For housing to contract by nearly 7%, in the second quarter, which is the spring quarter, which is the boom quarter for housing, residential housing construction, is significant. Housing is coming to a halt. Commercial property construction also slowing rapidly. Well, why is that? Well, number of factors, but one is it shows that even at 1.25% federal funds rate, that's the max that the very sensitive housing sector can absorb. So anything more is going to slow it even faster, contract it even faster, right? Housing has come to a dead stop as a contribution to U.S. GDP. Okay, how about autos? Well, the auto companies are losing a lot of money here as the auto market peaked and churned. And I've been predicting it would be coming down. Well, I was incorrect there. Actually, they sold more autos, durables autos, here in the second quarter. As a result of a return to these steep discounts to almost giving cars away here. Well, that can't go on too much longer. But that's how they're buying a little bit more time, right? Big discounts. You probably could get the deal of the decade here on autos here around Labor Day or the end of the year Christmas sales. So if you're looking for a new car, it's probably you get the best deal, biggest discounts and rebates. Okay, but that can't go on much longer. Okay, so why else do we have the 2.6 GDP? U.S. defense spending surged. Surprise, surprise. State and local government spending declined, but U.S. defense spending more than offset that. So that's a big contributor to 2.6% defense spending. What about consumption? Well, consumption growing 2% plus, largely because of household debt, people using credit cards and student debt and so forth, auto debt to purchase, and that's been propping up consumption. Okay. Also propping up consumption is the stock market. You know, the wealthiest 10% are those who buy stocks and so forth, and that going through the roof produces what's called a wealth effect. And that's pumped up the stock market a little bit. Also rising premiums for health care shows up as increases in healthcare activity. So these are the factors that have been boosting U.S. GDP, business investment spending, anticipation of tax cuts coming. That's part of it as well. Okay. What we've been hearing, though, is along with all this, is wage hype. You know, the press is indicating that, oh, wages are finally rising as part of this recovery. Right? Boy, is that a big misrepresentation. Most of it has been for the top 10% of the labor force who are getting some distribution from the tech companies. You get some wage increase just recently at the bottom 10% as certain states have been raising their minimum wage laws. So you get some gains at the extremes, at the top and at the very bottom. But in between the average, the middle class, the working class, is atrophying. Okay, let's look at some alternative figures here. Moody's research, investment research, you know, business source, reputable business source, recently published a report, data for the last 3 years, 2014-15-16, for businesses with employees over 50, which shows the following. The annual rate of wage growth, average wages, for all industries, last 3 years, according to Moody's, is 0.5% annually. 0.5%. Now that's Moody's data, and based on significant sample. Okay. What about education and healthcare? 0.6% annual increase. Leisure and hospitality. 0.8%. Manufacturing and construction, 0.5%. Even professional services, 1%. Now, it's a little higher for companies that employ less than 50 people because most of those people at those companies are employed at or near minimum wage, and the minimum wage increases here have raised income to a little over 1% annually increase for companies with less than 50 employees over the last 3 years. Okay. Well, that doesn't sound to me like booming wages. I don't know about you, but that's not a definition, you know, 0.5% to 1% annually. It doesn't strike me as an increase in wages. But you know what they do with these reports too, because inflation is declining slowing down the rate of growth of prices, PCE, 0.3%. It's really been coming down the last year in particular. What they do is argue that, okay, real wages may be rising because prices are falling faster than nominal wages. You know, that's how they come up with a lot of this manipulation in the Wall Street Journal and elsewhere. So the Moody's data, I think, is a better indication last 3 years. Average wages growing, you know, maybe 0.5% per year. Not much, is it? There was a report issued by a couple of economists, MIT economists, which was interesting here this past week. Based on a survey of 676 industries and 80% of the private sector in the U.S., the title of this is, quote, Fall of Labor Share and the Rise of Superstar Firms, unquote. Superstar firms being primarily tech firms, you see, and pharma companies, tech firms, banks, et cetera. Okay. And what this report concludes is that the more concentration you have in these industries, in other words, the fewer firms that dominate these industries and capture most of the market share of these industries, you have the greatest productivity gains by those few big behemoth companies. But they don't share those productivity gains with the rest of their labor force, you see. Big productivity gains, which means big cost savings, big profits, but it's not passed on. Not passed on to the rest of their workforce. So you get this gap in terms of labor share as you get concentration of industries, or monopolization, as we call it sometimes, right? There's another cause here, and that was revealed in another report called the Haldane Report. Haldane was the chief economist researcher for the Bank of England, right, whose study revealed that a rise of self-employment, independent contracts, contingent employment, gig employment, and so forth, is also playing a role in the falling labor share. So you got this double whammy going on, where the most profitable companies, the most productive, reaping huge profits, like the techs, right, at one end, and at the other end, other industries that aren't so profitable, right, because their productivity is not rising as fast, shifting towards contingent labor, part-time, temp, independent contract, right, self-employment kind of a labor, which lowers the wages and labor share. Two big developments going on here at opposite ends of the spectrum again, which are driving the falling labor share. And as labor share falls, and we saw that with the wage income, wage figures, right, labor workers, middle class, working class, attempt to maintain their standard of living by consuming via debt. And we see that with, the big three, credit card debt, student debt, right, medical debt now as well, and auto debt. Maintain the standard of living through debt. Now, that works while you have you don't have a recession. But once you have a recession and people lose their source of income, they can't service that debt. And another report shows, by the Census Bureau data and supplemented by the FDIC and Fed, shows that indebtedness, in other words, and the fact that they're consuming based on debt, not by wage income growth, shows that 37% of households, almost 40%, lack sufficient funds to pay their bills, minimum bills, for 3 months. 40% can't make it 3 months if they get laid off. And that's assuming bills based on poverty level wages, right? They don't have savings anymore. And the real cause of savings is irregular work. What do you mean by that? We mean people get these part-time jobs, temp jobs. You know, they work 3, 4, 5 months, get laid off again, right? That goes on continually. And that's not picked up adequately, I don't believe, in the unemployment figures either. Okay? So we get an overestimation of reduction of unemployment. But the real problem is irregular work. People don't have savings once they get laid off. They can't make it. Well, that means they're going to default on those cards and student loans and so forth, big time, and mortgages. The Federal Reserve estimated 47% of Americans are income insecure. In other words, don't have enough savings to get through 3 months. There's this other think tank called Prosperity Now, which released a report of its own, showing that households that have no savings whatsoever, 81% of Latino households are living paycheck to paycheck, no savings whatsoever. 57% of African-American households, no savings whatsoever. They don't even have the 3 months, you see. 28% of white Caucasian households. 20 million people, 20 million households, rather, right, owe more than their income. In other words, they are in the hole. Their net worth is negative. They have no assets. This is not a healthy picture of an economy able to sustain consumption over the longer run or able to weather another recession, should it come, which it will. Which it will. And then we go back to the MIT economist study, fall of labor share, right? Productivity has increased only 0.8% since 2010. It's in free fall since 2005. The last decade, productivity in free fall. During the 1960s, it was 3.5% on average. From 1985, 2002 percent on average. Now it's maybe 0.5% on average or less. Well, that represents an economy that's not reinvesting in itself, you see. Well, why is it not reinvesting? Why is business not reinvesting in job-producing businesses? I mean, and job-producing investments, or what we call real investment. Why is it not? Well, as I've said many times, I'm not going to elaborate on it. It's because all this money that they're getting, free money and excess liquidity and so forth, is going into stocks and bonds and other securities, or it's going offshore emerging markets with greater productivity, or it's just being hoarded. That's why we have no real productivity growth going on. And there are consequences to this, because if productivity is slowing or stagnant or declining, then that means there isn't going to be wage increases, because collapsing productivity results in higher unit labor costs for companies. And to offset the rising unit labor costs, which is a function of productivity and wages, if productivity is falling, they're going to take it out on wages to offset the decline in productivity, you see. And that's why we've got this wage stagnation going on. Because there's no real investment going on. And that's why we have the falling labor share, according to these MIT economists, you see. They're not looking at the real fundamental causes of this, you know. Why is labor share falling? Well, they're saying because we got concentration of superstar firms. But as I said, with that, what's behind that concentration, the superstar firms, the tech companies, so forth, is productivity growth is occurring there, but they're not sharing it. And elsewhere, there's no productivity growth going to share. In fact, it's so low, they're taking it out on wages, and that's why we get stagnant wages. And that's why we have households, middle and working class households, trying to maintain their standard of living by debt. You see, all this stuff gets connected. And the more debt you build up, and the less assets you have to survive a recession, when the recession comes, guess what you do? You don't pay the debt. You default. Financial asset prices began to collapse, and then we're off and running 2008. Okay. It's all connected, you see, and a lot of it comes back to the central banks. A lot of it also is attributable to the politicians, you know, passing tax cuts, which they're about to do again to benefit investors at the expense of the middle class and the rest of us. And that's been going on since Reagan, and it's been escalating, you know, accelerated during George W. Bush. Barack Obama continued it, allowed it to continue, and added some to it, and now Trump is escalating it even more. More tax cuts for investors and businesses. Well, you take from Peter, pay to Peter, you got to take from Paul, right? And that's what they're doing from the rest of us. You know, watch this Republican bill. They're going to take away deductions for households and middle class and in order to give tax cuts for wealthy investors again. We'll be following that very closely. This is a very important development, as important as this collapse of the healthcare situation in U.S. policy. All this is indication of a inability in the post 2008-09 period, this transition of capitalist policy and capitalist economy going on, inability to put the neoliberal Humpty Dumpty back together again. You see, kind of crashed there in 2008-09. And they've been trying to come up with a new formula, and they can't, because more important to them is to take from the rest of us in order to continue and add to, you know, the incomes of the 1%, maybe 5%, right? That's what it's all about. That's what's different, you see. Before it was all boats were rising and they could throw crumbs at everybody here in, you know, 45 to 75. Since 75, there's been recognition of a crisis, and Reagan and neoliberalism, you know, propped it up for another decade at the expense of free trade and tax cuts and all the other stuff, you know, gutting retirement plans and starting, precipitating this health care cost shift in the 90s under Clinton, right? All those were indications of growing difficulty in maintaining how the growth was distributed, you see. And the globalization, offshoring, was really all part of this shift. Well, the end of the game came in 2008-09, because part of their solutions, neoliberal solutions, led to financialization and the bust that dragged everything down, and they haven't been able to put it back together since then. And they're struggling. The Republicans are just saying, okay, and the Democrats, because the corporate money bags captured that party back in the late 80s, 90s, early 90s. It's all been how we can redistribute the money to keep the rich going and not put too much pressure on the rest of the folks. But now, after 20 years of that, the pressure is beginning to be felt. And you get a revolt going, you know, on the right and the left. Going on here. And you get the Democratic Party that became the Money Bags Party, the second wing of the Corporate Party of America here under Clinton, and pushed free trade and tax cuts for the rich and, you know, 401ks and all the rest that we know about. And, you know, that came to a peak here, and crisis peak in 2016 with Hillary, who attempted to continue pushing the same policy and ignore its impact on working classes and so forth. And, of course, we know that story. Now we've got, and this is the last item we'll mention here, we've got the report this week from the Democratic Party, a new thing called the Better Deal, the launching of the Better Deal, trying to appeal to, you know, the Rooseveltian New Deal, which was really significant. Better Deal is just a facade. Now, it's an attempt to somehow tap into the populist appeal and discontent that's going on that Trump did in a right-wing way, which, of course, he's quickly abandoned, that people thought that Obama would deliver on. Of course, that was false as well. Right? And now we got the Democratic Party, you know, coming up with its Better Deal announcement here this past week. Right. So we got the two wings of the Corporate Party of America trying to come up with a formula that appeals and fakes out the folks with this false populism, you see. It's not really populism. It's talk the talk and keep the money flowing to the rich. Right? As Chuck Schumer, who wrote an editorial here this past week, and when this thing was announced this past week, said that we're really going to shake things up, right? We're the party. We're going to show we're the party on the side of the working people. These are quotes from his article there. I think you can read it in the New York Times, right? Right. Well, what's he going to do? What's he going to do? Well, he says we've already moving to increase wages, and we're going to reduce expenses for working folks. And we're going to give them the tools they need. Three things: raise wages, reduce their costs, and give them tools that they need, right? And this launch Better Deal is going to come out in different elements over the next few months, as he says, right? He says we've already proposed a $1 trillion infrastructure plan. Well, so has Trump, right? And he says it's going to create 10 million jobs. Boy, is that a farce. No way you're going to create 10 million jobs with infrastructure spending. Plus, those kind of jobs are not permanent. They tend to go away after the infrastructure has been created. No 1 trillion jobs, but we don't have any details even what that looks like. 10 million jobs, don't believe it. Minimum wage, we're already proposing minimum wage to $15. Okay, I have a problem with that. See, the problem with the Democrats is that they appeal to the very rich money bags, and then they throw some crumbs on the very poorest, you know, to placate their consciences. But what happens to the middle class? What happens to all the working class, you know, earning $20,000 to $80,000 a year? They're the ones that are getting hollowed out. Oh, they're going to give them paid family and paid sick leave. Well, okay, I'm not opposed to that either, but that's not going to fundamentally change. Where is this middle class, working class program that they're talking about? It's not there. No mention whatsoever of unions, restoring unions, which have been almost eliminated, which played a big role in helping wage incomes recover for after recessions. It didn't this time because there's no unions to speak about. Okay, so, you know, infrastructure plan, minimum wage, sick leave. Okay, but that's not a program. All right, they said they're going to come out with some more on August 1st. Prescription drugs. Well, I hope so. Boy, we're getting gouged there, aren't we? Oh, Medicare is going to allow Medicare to negotiate with the drug companies. Okay, that's all right. I'm not against that, but that's not sufficient. Where's single-payer health care in all this? Well, the money bags of the Democratic Party hate that idea. That's why the Democrats wouldn't raise it. Bernie's raising it, but the Democrats aren't going to adopt Bernie's program, and Bernie is never going to reform the Democratic Party. Okay. Mergers, corporate mergers, they're going to propose on August 1st to restore antitrust reforms. In other words, a market solution to doing something about these big tech and pharma and banks and other companies. Competition. That's been shown the last half century as being a total farce. Doesn't work. Easy workarounds in a global economy, especially by corporations. You know, that's a big, big faker solution, corp antitrust. Come on, give me a break, right? Oh, and business tax cuts to train workers. Going to give them more tax cuts? What are you going to do about this big tax shift that's been going on for decades now? Not a word. Not a word about that. Just tax cuts for businesses. Well, how about tax cuts for workers? You know, and make the businesses pay for them for once, because we've been going the other direction for many years. And not a mention about free trade. This is the so-called Better Deal. Well, they better do better than the Better Deal, or it's going to go over like a lead balloon with the working classes, middle classes. All right. Next week, I'm sure there'll be news of interest. Jack Rasmussen, Alternative Visions.